All right. All right. Welcome, everyone. Sorry for the delay. I'd like to call to order the regular board meeting for the Santa Clara Valley Water Agency for January 19th, 2021. And we will move on to the Pledge of Allegiance. And I would ask Peter Ozahowski if he would like to recite the pledge for us. And I would ask everyone else to mute your devices and say it to yourself silently. Please, Peter, if you would.
Absolutely. Please stand and put your right hand on over your heart. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God. Can you hear me?
Yes. We can hear you. We can't hear you anymore, Peter.
Go ahead, finish up, Peter.
Excuse me, can you, Director Atkins, can you take over, please?
Yes, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
All right, thank you, everyone. We are disorganized, that's what we are. All right, been panicking with agency IT trying to get my machine to work, but we're up and we're running. Good to see everyone. And we move on to I have a number of comments, number of remarks I'd like to make before we begin the meeting. Please mute all of your devices until you are ready to speak to avoid feedback, echoing, and background noise. Make sure you unmute when speaking and remute when you are done speaking. All board members, please turn on your cameras during the meeting. Staff, please turn on your cameras when talking and turn them off when you are done speaking. Any member of the public, please do not turn on your cameras unless you are speaking during public comment, and then please turn them off when you have completed your comments. This meeting is being conducted in accordance with authorizations and requirements contained in Governor Newsom's Executive Order N-29-20, signed March 17, 2020. The board secretary will be calling on callers to identify themselves for ease in public comments. Please note that callers will be unmuted for public comment. Please be patient and give the board secretary time to unmute each of the callers. This will take just a few seconds. The public may comment on items covered on the agenda during item 3. Or may do so at the time each item is considered and will be limited to 3 minutes per comment. We will use the following procedure for approving items and taking public comments. I will introduce each agenda item. I will ask for questions from board members. I will then call for public comments. The board may then ask additional questions and discuss further if necessary, including public comments if desired. Once concluded, I will ask for a motion and a second, and after any further discussion, the board secretary will call for the vote. Any PowerPoints that will be shown at tonight's meeting can be viewed on the SCV Water website and are in the packet. Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll for attendance?
As I call your name, please say present. Director Kelly, are you present?
Present.
Director Bronstein, are you present?
Present.
Director Ed Colley, are you present? Let me unmute you, because I do have you muted.
Don't mute me. I'm here.
Okay, then there you are. Okay, I've got you. Thank you. Director Armitage, are you present?
Present.
Director Atkins, are you present?
Present.
Director Plambeck, are you present?
Yes, I'm here.
Director Ozahowski, are you present?
Present. Can you hear me, April?
Yes, I can. Thank you. Vice President Mortensen, are you present?
Present.
Director Cooper, are you present?
Present.
Vice President Gladbeck, are you present?
Yes.
And President Martin, are you still present?
Still present.
Very good. We are missing Director Ford tonight.
Thank you, April. We can now move on to item three, public comments. I would like to remind the public to unmute when speaking and remute when you have done, you have concluded your public comment. Tonight, I know we have a comment from Steve Petzold. So Steve, I invite you to go ahead with your public comment before I call on any other member of the public to speak.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the ability to address you this evening. I wanted to talk about the Obelisk project, which is scheduled to be placed at the entrance of Central Park. I know that this is a repetitive issue, but I think it's very important. The ad hoc committee really did not address the situation of the Obelisk. They had addressed the change of the naming on the sign. After reading the memorandum of understanding, I just don't understand why you don't seem to think that this is an important issue. The memorandum of understanding said that it was for parks and sports facilities purposes only, and that it had to be compatible with CLW's desire for a public use buffer zone. The close proximity of the obelisks to the entrance of the agency is not compatible with you having a buffer zone there. What I'm urging you to do is to schedule an agenda item in which you consider the project in its totality. Take a look at whether SCV water security needs are met with placing this obelisk in that area. Is the public really being kept safe in that site? I'm also concerned, as you may be aware, with one of the design elements of the obelisk, which includes a logo for the nonprofit corporation formed by the families for raising funds. Mr. Gladback, are you laughing?
I was repositioning my back.
Distracting. That may well constitute commercial activity. I brought to the city's attention the fact that there were no plaques there, and then the city said, well, there's going to be a plaque, we just don't know what it's going to say. The commercial activity is not to be permitted on the site. The only way to determine whether these design elements meet the desires of SCB Water in compliance with the original memorandum of understanding is for you to put the item on the agenda and have members of the city come forward with the complete and total design and ask whether they gave any consideration at all to whether your security buffer was considered in the location of the sign. I believe it wasn't. This project was totally turned over to the parents of the children, and the city gave up control of what the item would look like. They gave up on the item of the location. It was just carte blanche, whatever the family wanted. I believe it's your obligation as directors of SCV Water to make sure that this project is in compliance with the MOU and the lease agreement you have with the city. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Petzold, for your comment. Are there any other members of the public who would like to speak tonight on item three?
Yes, Cam Noltemeyer.
Please proceed, Ms. Noltemeyer.
Because we have new board members, this is a little history prior to the formation of the Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency. In November of 2006, Castaic Lake Water Agency Board of Directors authorized $90 million in debt financing for construction projects over the next 3 to 5 years. Castaic Lake Water Agency would be paying back $5.4 million per year for approximately 30 years to its investors who would buy parts of construction projects. The Santa Clarita Valley County Water District has refunded debt of $232,594,000 and added new debt of $55,101,090 in 2020. You know, they say history doesn't repeat itself, but it certainly seems it has in this case. Thank you.
Unmute myself. Thank you, Ms. Noltemeyer. Are there any other members of the public who would like to speak on item three? Any other members of the public who have comment on item three?
Hi, good evening. This is Brian Milberger. I do.
Go ahead, Mr. Milberger.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I wanted to clarify a few comments made on the public comments that were emailed in from Mr. Petzold in relation to the obelisk project by the city of Santa Clarita. A couple things. First and foremost, the actual area that's been selected was selected by the city. We gave suggestions on areas where we would like. They proposed the area. They laid out the entire design of the actual layout of the area. We just wanted a place to put the obelisks, and we had ideas of where we wanted it. The city did the rest. The actual design of the obelisks are actually done in cut mosaic tile. It's cut in really, really small pieces. They're probably centimeter by centimeter in size, and they're archaically cut, that the imagery on an obelisk is not actually capable of infringing on a trademark. In fact, the same company has done work for the Kobe Bryant Foundation and their families with Lakers logos on jerseys that have been approved to not infringe upon any sort of trademark. They're just imagery. They just depict general ideas and concepts. In the actual artist renderings used by the city of Santa Clarita for the proposal and approval last week, those are just artist samples and drafts that will actually look very different when actually formed. You will see a G, you will see a St. Louis Cardinals logo, you will see a Dodgers logo, you will see other imagery on there that represent the two children. The G in this case is used by the Gracie Strong Foundation and is a trademark that we are working on. But at the same time, it's actually, because it was actually how she used to sign her name at the end of her little letters to us. It was a little G that she would put on her letters, and we actually had it digitized. And then lastly, there are trademarked logos used throughout many of the facilities across all of the parks in Santa Clarita on various tiles and plaques and stone, and actually in Central Park at the Youth Grove. This is not something new. I don't think SCB Water needs to be worried about. Definitely not an issue for safety by having people visit and hang around that area, because people are the ones that are in that area. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to me, and I wanted to clarify those comments. And if you have any questions, I'll be on the line.
Thank you, Mr. Muehlberger. Are there any other members of the public who would like to speak on item three, public comment? Any other members of the public who would like to speak at this time? Hearing none, we will move on to approval of the amended agenda. I think there was a minor amendment made for page numbering. So I would entertain a motion for approval of the agenda.
So moved, amended. Lynn Planbeck.
Motion by Mr. Director Planbeck. Do I have a second?
Seconded, Director Cooper.
Second by Director Cooper. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Director Armitage, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Bronstein, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Cooper, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Ossofsky, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Atkins, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Colley, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Kelly, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Planbeck, how do you vote?
Yes.
Vice President Mortensen, how do you vote?
Yes.
Vice President Gladbeck, how do you vote?
Yes.
President Martin, how do you vote?
Yes.
The amended agenda has been approved.
All right, thank you. Even though it's after the fact, are there any members of the public who would like to comment on item four, approval of the amended agenda? Hearing none, we can move on to item 5, approval of the consent calendar. We have 2 items on the consent calendar. I would entertain a motion for approval of the consent calendar.
Jerry moves.
Motion by Vice President Gladbach.
Second.
Second by Vice President Mortensen, I believe. Are there any members of the public who would like to comment before we call the roll?
I believe this is where I get to chime in, right? And under 5.2, are you approving the minutes for the last meeting?
Yes, we are.
Okay, I would like you to amend the meetings to reflect the fact that General Manager Matt Stone asked the directors to give him some direction as to what to do about the misstatements made in the local press regarding the actions you took regarding the memorial sign. Although you refused to give him direction, he did ask for that, given the fact that the motion of the city had not been agreed to, and you had made a counter proposal, and the media is constantly saying that you appended the name, or that most recently the Signal reports that you dedicated the park. So I believe it's important to reflect the fact that that Matt Stone asked you to give him direction as to how to proceed, and in your wisdom, you decided not to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Petzl. Any other member of the public who would like to comment? We have a motion and a second. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Director Plambeck, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Atkins, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Armitage, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Cooper, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Ozahofsky, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Colley, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Kelly, how do you vote?
Yes.
Director Bronstein, how do you vote?
Yes.
Vice President Gladbach, how do you vote?
Yes.
Vice President Mortensen, how do you vote?
Yes.
President Martin, how do you vote?
Yes.
Thank you. The consent calendar has been approved.
Thank you. We can move on to item 6. We have a number of presentations tonight, and we will begin with presentation item number 6.1, presentation regarding Department of Water and Power reduced releases from Bouquet Canyon Reservoir, an update regarding Lark Ranch Pipeline Project. The presenters tonight are Steve Cole and Brett Payne. So unless we have further comment from the general manager, I'll turn it over to Mr. Cole and to Mr. Payne.
Sure. Just a quick comment. We do, as we're dealing with power outages, Steve's power did go off as the meeting started. So we will give this a shot. If he can be heard okay, we'll do the bouquet release piece. If not, we may have to carry it over.
Give it a shot.
Are you there, Steve? Okay, what I would suggest is if we can skip ahead to Brent Payne's section, which discusses the pipeline portion, we can talk about that, and we're happy to bring back the other piece either later tonight or in a future meeting. That's all right.
Works for me.
Are you
yes,
available?
Try that.
I may be 0-2 here.
No, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay. All right, go for it.
Okay, all right, thanks. Thanks.
And
I know the Bouquet Reservoir was going to provide some introduction and context for the Lark, but I'll go ahead and give it. I'm Brent Payne, one of the principal engineers with SCP Water for the new directors. Welcome. I'd like to give you a brief overview of the pipeline project that's to serve LARC, the Los Angeles residential community. And I'll give you an update on our current funding application process. Next slide, please. This vicinity map shows the general area of the project along Bouquet Canyon Road in the northeast portion of our service area. There are two communities, the LARC community and the Lily of the Valley Mobile Home Village, that maintain public water supplies that are located within our service area, but outside our current distribution network. Both are on Bouquet Canyon Road in the unincorporated portion of LA County. Lily of the Valley Mobile Home Village is just outside the city limits, east of Shadow Valley Lane. And then LARC community is just northeast of Vasquez Canyon Road. Next slide, please. So this project will build a new 12-inch ductile iron pipeline along Bouquet Canyon Road. The new pipeline will connect to our system near the city limits at the intersection of the Shadow Valley Lane and Bouquet Canyon Road in the lower left on the map here. And then extend about 9,600 feet or roughly 1.8 miles up to the LARC community. For those that are not familiar with the LARC community, they are a nonprofit 501c organization that includes about 100 residents who are disabled adults living on fixed incomes. When LARC was founded over 50 years ago, they built a water system with two wells, a storage tank, and a distribution system. This project is eligible for grant funds from the State Water Board based on a consolidation of the LARC water system into our SCV water system. How this consolidation would work is we would install a master meter in front of the LARC property to provide them with a source of domestic water. SCV Water, we will own and operate the pipeline up to and including the master meter. LARC would continue to own and operate their on-site distribution system, but would be required to disconnect their wells and relinquish their water permit with the state. Recently, the state asked us as part of this grant application to consider also consolidating the Lily of the Valley Mobile Home Village using the same master meter approach. Which we're currently working on. So Lily of the Valley has two wells, tanks, and a distribution system. Next slide, please. So in recent years, LARC's two on-site wells have essentially dried up due to a lack of groundwater recharge caused by the lack of releases from the Bouquet Reservoir, as well as the prolonged drought. As a result, LARC has been purchasing water from the nearest public hydrant that's about 2 miles away and hauling water to their facility to fill their on-site storage tank. And they've been doing this since about 2014, so nearly 7 years. The proposed pipeline would provide a reliable, good quality, and sustainable water supply for LARC. For Lily of the Valley, as well as other residences along this 2 mile stretch of Bouquet Canyon Road. And I might add that the State Water Board encourages projects like this because it brings, it's an opportunity to bring small, struggling water systems like LARC and Lily of the Valley into compliance with safe drinking water standards for their water supplies by consolidating them into a regional public water system like SCV Water. Next slide, please. So the state board makes available grant funds for consolidations from the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund. In keeping with the state's objective of consolidation, the grant covers all of the project costs relative to serving LARC and Lily of the Valley. In this case, we did a hydraulic analysis and determined that an 8-inch pipeline would be sufficient to serve LARC and Lily of the Valley, so the grant covers the cost in its entirety of constructing an 8-inch pipeline. And so the grant is comprehensive in that it covers all associated project costs, such as master meters, the capacity fees, as well as costs for planning, design, and construction. However, in looking forward to building a pipeline, SCV Water wants to upsize the pipeline so that other residences along the pipeline route can connect that are similarly on their own private wells that are running dry. So based on further hydraulic analysis, we determined that a 12-inch pipeline would give us the capacity we need to serve other existing residences. So the pipeline size, upsize from 8-inch to 12-inch is a marginal cost of about $700,000 that's not eligible for grant funds. We're budgeting this $700,000 in our CIP to cover the cost of upsizing, and that represents a total project cost of about $3.5 million, 2.7 for the LARC pipeline. An important benefit of this grant project or program is that the state offers additional funds over and above the consolidation grant that we can use for other projects such as PFAS treatment. So in this case, they're actually offering an additional $1 million grant and $10 million in a 0% loan. And we're currently working with the state to select the what they call the incentive projects to be able to use those funds. Next slide, please. Here's a brief rundown of the history of this grant application process. The Castaic Lake Water Agency Board initiated the grant application back in 2016 on behalf of LARC. CEQA, Mitigated Negative Declaration, was prepared and adopted in 2017. Staff then prepared and submitted the full grant application in 2017, which included four packages. The technical package included full plans and specs for the pipeline. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the state asked us to expand the scope of this application to include Lily of the Valley, Mobile Home Village, and part of this was to help them secure additional grant funds from the state revolving fund for the project. And so that's we're following up on that. Next slide, please. So this is the final slide. Next steps are basically to finalize our updates to the grant application, working with the state, and that includes including the Lily of the Valley in our design plans, specs, and cost estimates. And we hope to get formal approval from the state in the second quarter of this year. We'll advertise for bids for the pipeline, which will allow us to update the funding agreements with hard costs for construction. And then we'll be coming back to the board later this year for approval of funding agreements and to award construction of the pipeline. In the meantime, sort of concurrent with this, we'll be submitting grant application documents for the incentive projects to take advantage of the additional grant and loan money. If all goes as planned, we hope to construct the pipeline next year and bring it online by the end of 2022. So this presentation, just for your information, there's no action to take tonight, but that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Brent. Are there any questions from the board on Brent's presentation before we ask if Steve Coles managed to get on?
Yes, I have questions, Mr. Martin.
Go ahead, Director Planbeck.
Thank you for your presentation, and I'm really glad to see that we are helping to get water to LARC Ranch and that it's a state grant because it's enormously expensive for these small projects. So it's really wonderful when the state helps us with this stuff. But I do have some questions. I didn't catch how long the pipeline is going to be, the 8-inch pipeline that you're putting in and expanding to 12.
So it's about 9,600 feet, so roughly 1.8 miles. And it extends from Shadow Valley Lane up to LARC. So basically, and it'll be within the public right away in Bouquet Canyon Road.
Okay, so I was not on the board at the time that the mitigated negative declaration for it was approved. Does the mitigated negative declaration include a 12-inch pipe or a 8-inch pipe?
So we prepared the mitigated negative deck for the 12-inch pipe, with the idea, and we documented in the CEQA mitigated negative deck that we anticipated other existing users, residences along the route would want to connect. So that was included.
OK, Okay, so you didn't do growth-inducing impacts because it's just existing residents?
That's absolutely correct. You hit the nail on the head there. We were advised by legal counsel, BBK, not to upsize the pipe, you know, for growth, just for that very reason, because we didn't want to have challenges or hurdles that might affect the approval for LARC, actually, because the project is, you know, primarily for them. So.
Okay, well, I would appreciate seeing a copy of that mitigated negative declaration again, because I was not on the board at that time. And I'm sure you're aware that a pipeline of that length, when you would upsize it, would require CEQA review, not a mitigating negative declaration. So if it does start, if we do start having development up there, and I will express my concern over building in those wildfire areas when we have this roaring wind tonight to show why there's issues with it. You know, I really think if we're going to attach any new development, we really have to think about changing the mitigated negative declaration. So I just want to say that now. But I thank you so much for doing this grant application. I think it's really important to get these small folks accommodated.
And we can get you a copy of the CEQA MND.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Planbeck. Are there any other questions from the board before we ask if Steve Cole is able to get back on? No further questions from the board. I appreciate, Brent, your presentation. Is Steve Cole on the line, able to do the first part of the presentation before I ask for public comment?
Hello, President Martin. This is Steve. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. All right, we can do the front half.
So bear with me here. I am literally flying dark.
So, all right.
I am in my mobile office in the car. So, but I do have the presentation, and I believe I can run through it for the board. So let's go ahead and give this a try. April, are you ready for the first slide?
I am ready.
And we're on the one Bouquet Creek releases.
We're on your cover page. Yeah.
Okay, go to the next slide, please. So tonight's presentation, you heard part of it, which was going to be the last bullet point, but we'll do it in reverse order tonight. We want to give you, the board, a basic history lesson, understand a little bit more about the current status of the releases, the stakeholders that are involved, and then also looking at SCV Water's role in coming up with the solution. Next slide, April. So you may have already got a little bit of this from Brent. So, you know, orientation, obviously we're talking about Bouquet Canyon. We're talking about Bouquet Reservoir. And then the wells that Brent had mentioned of impact are highlighted there in kind of that orange color. Next slide, April. So wanted to give the group a little bit of history lesson. Obviously, this has been around for a long time. The reservoir construction goes all the way back to 1932. Found some cool pictures here. For board members that haven't had the opportunity, I highly recommend going to SCV TV, and they actually have kind of a sister web page of scvhistory.com. Really cool pictures of not only Bouquet Reservoir, but just little snippets of history of the Santa Clarita Valley. So if you haven't found kind of this hidden gem, I would highly recommend you go and take a look at this website and the different, you know, information about our valley that's on it. April, next slide. Here's another photo. You know, obviously you can tell the dam taking shape here. This one's from 1933. Next slide, April. So a little bit about the history, kind of from a contract perspective. In 1932, so this was before the reservoir actually became operational, LA Department of Water and Power, who was the entity constructing the reservoir, entered into a contract with what was known at that time the Santa Clara Water Conservation District. That agency was actually the predecessor to United Water Conservation District. So one of our partners downstream was the entity in which DWP entered into contract with. And that contract was basically to handle the impoundment of the water, basically the storm flows that historically would have come into the watershed and traveled down Bouquet Creek and then further on down into the Santa Clara River watershed. So this was to basically make sure that that amount of water was released through a contract so that there would not be an impact to downstream, habitat or groundwater. 1934, Bouquet Reservoir was placed in operation. Little unknown fact, this is basically within 5 years of the St. Francis Dam disaster. That blew me away that, they actually had another reservoir constructing that short in time period after that disaster. I think just a statement in history and time and the way things used to happen, right or wrong. 1978, there was a contract update. Again, that contract update was between LA Department of Water and Power and United Water Conservation District. By this time, they had had over 40 years of operational history on the reservoir, and what they learned is that just like the watershed, it has years that has low amounts of flow in the watershed and years when it has a huge amount of flow in the watershed. And what they did is looked at the hydrology and looked at the average, and that's where they ended up at the 2,100 acre feet to release roughly annually. And that agreement did something unique in that it allowed for the release of the water in more of a uniform fashion rather than kind of the boom and bust releases of the past. Next slide, April. So 1934, the opening ceremonies here, you can see, the water started flowing from the reservoir and down Bouquet Creek. Next slide, April. So what happened? The releases had been going on for quite some time, but in 2002, wildfire happened. A large fire within that area of the watershed, and then that was followed a couple of years later by the major storm event. And what happened was is that the creek itself silted up in the canyon, and that's prevented releases basically since that time, so 2005 to current. That lack of being able to release water over roughly the last 15 years has it actually ended up in about an 11,000 acre foot difference over that time period. As was mentioned earlier, that impacts some private pumpers in the area. It also impacts the habitat along the way. Next slide, April. So this is what it looks like. So this is when they try and release water over a certain amount nowadays. And this is a picture of Bouquet Canyon Road, and the water ends up going across the road. And it causes a pretty significant safety hazard for those of you that have been able to drive up the canyon. You know the road. It's windy and it's dangerous. And when you have water, standing water on it, it makes those conditions even more so. Next slide, April. Just another kind of picture of that. Next slide, April. This is just a picture of some of the kind of rougher improvements that have been tried to be made to help the water not encroach on the road. As you can see, this kind of almost hand dug little culvert to try and prevent that from happening. Next slide, April. A little hydrograph for everybody. You know, this just shows that this picking up at 1980, basically from that new contract to present, kind of that sporadic nature, it basically, you know, was flat for the first 15 plus years of the agreement. And then the silt event happened in 04, 05. You can see the impacts of that, significant reductions in flow. They did try for several years, you can see there, to return to releases. I believe there was quite a few safety issues that happened when the county and LADWP tried to start releasing that water again. And therefore, you can see the tail again kind of coming way back down on the releases. And then they've kind of reached an equilibrium point now where they release the maximum they can without having major road infringement. You can see that it's roughly about half of what the contractual amount should be for the releases. Next slide, April. A little bit about stakeholders. You know, a lot of people, I think, have gotten frustrated with the inability to resolve the issue. It's a complex issue as you start to get involved with it. One of the things that makes it so complex is the large amount of stakeholders involved. You know, you've got LA County Department of Public Works, which is basically kind of a lead, but obviously you've got LA Department of Water and Power, you got the United Water Conservation District, you've got all the regulatory agencies in that hold jurisdiction over the area. And, you know, you've got the private pumpers, you've got others that are interested in the area that maybe like to see different things done with habitat or the way that the releases are done. So it makes it a really complicated group to get together and manage on a solution moving forward. Department of Public Works, you can go to the next slide, April, is really functioning as the lead agency on the current status. You know, their focus the last several years has been on the creek restoration. You've got a assembly bill that was actually passed, Assembly Bill 353 by Lackey, that was meant to give a little bit of help to coming up with a solution in that it deals with endangered species, specifically the unarmored three-spined stickleback in the habitat in that area. And that was passed in 2015. And it basically provides a roadmap for being able to do creek restoration and without impacting the endangered species in the area. The counties retained CDM consultants in 2017 to do a feasibility study. That's been a lot of work going on for them to kind of catalog what is going on in the area and what potential improvements need to be made. As you can imagine, it's not as simple as just digging out the creek. There's road issues, there's the issue of long-term maintenance of the creek, and so it gets pretty complicated pretty fast. So working group, I mentioned all those stakeholders earlier. A working group was formed in 2018 to try and coalesce around a solution. A little bit more on current status, LADWP did file a water rights application in 2018. That's basically dealing with the impoundment of the water. So the water that they haven't been able to release, you actually need a permit to keep the water. So, and by keep, I mean store it for future release. And so they are processing a water rights application to accomplish that. Obviously, again, the loss of recharge has impacted private groundwater pumpers in Boque Canyon, and it continues to do that. Next slide, April. So what's our role? Well, we were asked as an agency, and this was in your board packet, we received a letter from the Groundwater Sustainability Agency to up Santa Clarita Valley Water's role in participating, and really to try and help with the leadership to find a solution. So we're starting that process now. We're meeting with key stakeholders. We've met with DWP. We've met with the county. We've met with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, mainly in a fact-finding mission to understand where people are at and what their current objectives are. So that's going to help us define the path forward. April, next slide. So that really concludes the process. Wanted to make sure we started to educate the board on what, you know, the issues are within Boque Canyon and the creek releases. And then really, you know, having staff start to dig into what role can the agency play in ultimately coming up with solutions. So I'll stop there and I'll be happy to answer any questions that the board may have.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate the presentation. Excellent. So I will open it up to questions from the board, but I think since I think there'll be a number of questions, I'm going to go ahead and do it in order of our directors by alphabetical. Director Armitage, do you have any questions for Steve on this presentation?
Not at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you. Director Atkins, since you're the author of the letter asking for the action, do you have any questions for Steve or from Brent, actually, either one on their presentations?
Well, first, I'd like to say thank you, President Martin, and nice job, Steve, on laying out what the conditions are in the canyon. Just by way of background, I want the board to know that my formative years were spent I spent a lot of hours as a child in that canyon playing in that stream. And it's a place of passion for me. And now that I'm serving as the president of the Groundwater Sustainability Agency, I can see the complete nexus between the lack of water flow and the recharge that Lark Ranch has lost. And it's devastating to witness the decline of that watershed over the years. Here's my question, Steve. If you had to assign a percentage, there's a number of issues, and I know it's a lot of moving parts, but if you had to assign a percentage in terms of what percentage does the Endangered Species Act play in the potential for resolution here? Is it more than 50%? Is it 80% of the problem? Is it 20% of the problem? Just give me a round number if you can, please.
Obviously putting a percentage on it's a difficult thing. It's a very dynamic issue within the canyon. It clearly plays a role. In our discussions with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, this is a very unique situation in which you have the habitat that is supportive of an endangered species, but the actual endangered species has been compromised genetically in that canyon, and that's something that U.S. Fish and Wildlife shared with us. So what you have in there are partially or non-armored stickleback. And so I had originally thought it was playing a much larger role, but I think the fishery agencies are open to solutions, as long as the solutions are focused on not only cleaning out and making sure that there's a healthy creek, but that there's habitat that is valuable for the different species that are there within the watershed.
Thank you. If you have had a chance to read my letter from the Groundwater Sustainability Agency, you'll see that it's an impassioned plea for public safety because water running across the road is a function of siltation of many of the culverts, and it's a safety hazard presently. If we had a storm event, thank God we're in a La Nina, but if we have a couple of large storm events, people's health it's going to compromise public safety. I'll just say it that way, because it's just a matter of time before somebody spins out. You saw pictures. Someone is going to get injured in that canyon. And that's not SCV Water's responsibility per se, but I appreciate the candor with which you presented the lack of significant control the Endangered Species Act has on this and how cooperative the fisheries agencies seem to line up. I'm of the opinion that if SCV Water can take a leadership role, as they already have started, we can run this to the end in a way that makes sense so that it actually does become the recharge area it should. And public safety is kind of the gravy. So we really, really need to take action and continue to press this because it's been languishing for 15 years. And it's surprising to me that someone's not gotten hurt already. And I'm going to get off my soapbox. I just want you to all know that this is a very important thing to me. And I'd really like the board to continue to ask staff to take this leadership role and push this to a swift resolution. Someone's going to get hurt. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Atkins. Director Bronstein, do you have any questions for Steve?
No, thank you. Not at this time.
Thank you. Director Colley, do you have any questions for Steve?
I'm not sure if we have a question. I wouldn't even know how to phrase the question, but kind of a concern. Confusion. I think I have confusion would be the best way to phrase it. The Groundwater Agency, is their involvement in this is obvious, and why they should be involved is very obvious. And I also understand that there's quite a bit of overlap between the Groundwater Agency and the us, the Water Agency. But what I'm confused about is how, what is our dog in the fight? And why would we be taking the leadership role? And I'm trying to figure out why the Groundwater Agency isn't in the leadership role. And if they need more resources to do that, that would sort of be a different question than having the Water Agency take a leadership role. And so I'm kind of confused in my own head as to what we could do, what we should do, and exactly what even is being asked of us as the Water Agency. So I'm not sure that's really not a question. It's just a lot of confusion in my head.
Steve, do you want to take a shot at responding to that? The way I see it is both agencies access the same expertise and the same technical staff. So it's a matter of whose name you put on it. But Steve?
Yeah, I think we – sure. I can take a stab at trying to answer. And Director Colley, I think it's a natural question to have or concern to have. We did talk about it quite a bit at the Groundwater Sustainability Agency meeting. At that point in time, it felt that the Water Agency was better positioned to have that discussion specifically with some of the stakeholders involved. Talking Water Agency to Water Agency in many cases is an easier discussion to have than talking from a groundwater sustainability agency. And as you reflect, I mean, part of it may be because that the groundwater sustainability agency is still in its kind of infancy of development and understanding, you know, the role that it ultimately is going to play. So I don't have a perfect answer other than it was talked about. We decided to bring the issue up before the SCV Water Board, and this is the first step in doing that, is to get educated. Ultimately, the water agency made you know, decide that it belongs back in the GSA, but wanted to get everybody up and familiar with the issues. And this is what I would consider the first step in understanding those issues and how they impact, you know, the water agency and or the groundwater sustainability agency.
Right. So given that sort of an answer, and I appreciate it very much, and I do appreciate the education. I'm delighted to get the briefing, and I'm delighted to be brought up to speed on more of what the issues are. But my initial thought is more along the lines of the water agency providing assistance to the groundwater agency. And I would hope that the groundwater agency could, in its own name, so to speak, and I think in its own name it has more clout, frankly. It has a legal, an obvious legal mandate to address these kinds of problems. And so I'd be inclined to encourage us to assist the groundwater agency in pursuing remedies, rather than doing it in the name of the water agency, that I'm not sure that we have sufficient legal mandate to really take a leadership role. So that's just my thought, and I think you summarized it quite well. It's kind of like whose name goes on the letterhead, kind of a question, and maybe it ought to be the groundwater agency more than us. So thank you. Just my thoughts initially.
Thank you, Director Collier. I also would appreciate, as we move through this, to try to get some more clarity on this. And this whole question should be on people's minds as we go through it, so that we can reach a point where we can clearly say whose issue is this to resolve. So thank you, Director Collier. Director Cooper, do you have any questions?
Just a couple of comments. Thank you, Steve. That was very good, and it clarified some things, I think, that have been out there for a long time. I agree with Director Colley. I think the Groundwater Sustainability Agency should be the lead agency in this. In the past, it was the old CLWA, but it's time for GSA to take that over. And, of course, Mr. Cole is the CEO of the GSA, and it's this board that actually pays the bills. So it's good to bring it to this board to get an understanding before the GSA goes forward. It was encouraging to hear, Steve, that it's not the endangered species concerns that it was in the past years, because pretty much that was all it was in the past years, is they couldn't do anything because of the endangered species. If there's a way to be able to do this now, because that upstream species has become something hybrid, I think this is going to be a great opportunity for us to get that thing cleared out. The benefit to the agency is there's about 2,100 or 2,200 acre feet at least a year that would come down that creek and goes into our basin. And help support our basin. So, yeah, I think that's a significant amount of water, and that we need to be on top of that. So hopefully we can continue to have the GSA move forward on this. Thank you very much for the presentation, Steve.
Thank you, Director Cooper. Vice President Gladbach, do you have any questions for Steve?
No questions, a few comments. The following up on what Bill was saying, you know, not only is it 2,200 acre feet a year, but there's also a lot kept back there on storage. Want to comment on some things, BJ. Well, first of all, too, I agree GSA should be in charge of it. Also, going back, BJ, when you were used to have fun up there, you remember Fish and Game used to stock it with trout, and that was a good fishery, you know, throughout the whole summer for that recreation area. The one to comment on Bouquet Reservoir, the water and power in the early mid-20s, really knew they wanted significant storage south of the San Andreas Fault. And that's why they built St. Francis Dam. Unfortunately, it failed. It was a concrete arch structure. They immediately looked elsewhere to have a significant storage. They ended up with Bouquet Reservoir. And difference in the dam was designed was that Bouquet Reservoir as an earth-filled dam. So significantly different than what St. Francis Dam was. So yeah, it was not surprising that it was built soon after the St. Francis Dam failure, Steve. And that's all.
Thank you, Jerry. Director Kelly, do you have any questions for Steve? Director Kelly?
Director Martin, I don't see, or President Martin, I don't see him on anymore.
All right.
So I'm not sure if he's there.
All right. Vice President Mortensen, do you have any questions for Steve on the presentation?
I appreciated the education. I don't have any more questions. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you very much. All right. Director Ozahosky, do you have any questions for Steve?
I do. Thanks again, Mr. Gold, for an informative briefing. Regarding the CDM consultants that were retained in 2017, what have they provided so far?
Yes, thank you, Director Zasowski. So far, they are in the final stages of completing a feasibility report. So I believe, you know, a lot of it is looking at the challenge of desilting the area, the creek, and not only, you know, desilting it once, but, you know, we have fires all the time. So it's how do you do something that is going to provide for maintenance long term? They're also looking at the restoration areas that would be necessary, and then I believe they're also looking at significant road improvements that may be necessary to assist mainly with the first one, with being able to have an area that you can more easily maintain the silting issue in the future.
Okay, regarding the this silting and long-term maintenance, have they suggested any plans on which agency or which department will be kind of responsible for that in the long term?
Yeah, it's a pretty unique situation in that a large portion of the creek is in forest, the national forest area. So right now, the Department of Public Works has taken the lead role through the supervisor's office, as they do play a role for the roadway and also when it comes into kind of the unincorporated county area. So that's why they are leading the efforts to try and move a solution forward.
Are they also looking at potential costs for all of this as well, and include that in the report?
Yes, I believe there is going to be cost information included in the report. And ultimately, I would imagine more than anything, that will be the the big hurdle involved is probably going to take not only, you know, county resources, but also grant funding to make the entire project viable.
Well, with so many stakeholders, maybe we can spread this cost equally. Okay, understood. And when will when do you think this report will be available? At least the first draft.
Yeah, let me check in with the county. They were the ones that had mentioned that I believe it is near complete, but I will try and track that down and see if we can get a copy of it.
Okay, thank you. And thank you again for the presentation.
Thank you, Director Ozahosky. Director Planback, again, you are last, but you'll be first on the next presentation. So, Director Planback, do you have any questions for Steve?
Yes, I do. And thanks for warning me that I'll be first on the next one, so I'll be ready. This has been going on for a long time with a lot of stakeholders, and so I'm a little bit hesitant that we should be jumping in with both feet at the last minute to try to resolve issues where, to a large extent, there's been a lot of talking, and as Steve said, a lot of it has to do with funding. Lackey passed that bill, 353, in, you know, 5 years ago, so that they could move forward with the mitigation area. The Forest Service, I think, chose, I don't remember the name of the campground up there, but I know that our group commented on that would be a viable mitigation area in that one campground. Steve, what's going on with that? Because I think that's a prerequisite to doing all of this. Do you know where that is? The mitigation?
I do know that it's been talked about utilizing, and I'm drawing a blank on the campground too. But
I think,
yeah,
it starts with a Z, but I don't remember.
Yeah, that is part of the restoration efforts. And I think what has happened, I don't think COVID has done anybody any favors, because there was a working group, as you mentioned, with a lot of the stakeholders involved, and that group has not been able to meet for quite some time now. So I don't know the exact status of it, but that is part of what we are trying to gauge on and just determine how we can be an effective stakeholder within a process and hopefully help lead the process forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if we'd be leading when they've already been working on it for so long. I know the problem with the road was a matter of county funding. They needed to do the restoration and they needed to find funding for that. So maybe if we jumped in and wanted to give them several million dollars or help them write grants or something, that might be helpful. But I do want to say that we have, to the rest of the board, we have done considerable work towards this in our grant writing for Lark Ranch. Lark Ranch was one of the downstream users that was affected by this lack of flows. And it's, you know, the grant to extend the pipeline is, and to the and to the mobile home park as well, is trying to help the stakeholders in this. And I'm a little concerned that our agency would be doing it on behalf of the pumpers, because that seems to me sort of a special interest, and they already have their intervention and legal arguments in the pot, so to speak. So, you know, I don't think we should be doing it on behalf of particular pumpers. If it's going to help the recharge for the area, then that's fine. But I also want us to tread gently, because people have worked very hard to get this going, and with all the funding problems and the mitigation requirements and mainly the funding problems, I think, were the big issue. Short of us wanting to fund these projects, I don't know exactly how us putting one more big mouth into it is going to really help. But I don't know. Whatever. I'm not excited about getting involved. I just think they need funding. But perhaps grant writing would be some help anyway, maybe our department can help with that.
Thank you, Director Planback. I have no questions for you, Steve. I appreciate the presentation. I appreciate the history lesson and all the input that we've gotten from all of our boards. So I would open it up to public comment. Are there any members of the public who would like to comment on item 6.1, the presentation as described in the agenda? April, do we have the public unmuted on this?
We do. Does not appear that anybody has any public comment.
Very good. Thank you. Then we can move on to item 6.2, PFAS groundwater treatment implementation plan update. General Manager Stone, do you have any words before we turn it over to the senior members of your strike team for the presentation?
Just want to check in with both Mike and Steve and make sure they're technologically ready. If not, I can pinch hit for any part.
Captain PFAS is here.
Okay, we've got Captain PFAS. Steve, just let me know if it's too much. I'll try to get through. I think I'm more familiar with this than the LARC or the prior one. So we're a little better positioned, but we've got a great first team on the field. So go right ahead, Mike.
Okay, Mike batting lead off. Okay, thank you, Mike. Go ahead.
Okay, great. April, you want to go to the next slide? I'm not good with agenda items on a presentation, but I didn't prepare this. So I'm going to give you a little introduction. Well, good evening, everybody, first. I guess we should start there. Hope everybody's safe and healthy. Director Armitage, I remember you from years ago. Welcome. Welcome, everybody. And then we'll do a little background, and then I'll turn it over to Steve to talk about our response and outreach and to finish up the things. So let's go into it. April, please. It was May of 2018 where we were first introduced to this group of constituents or contaminants called PFAS, per and polyfluoroalkyl substances. I think we're all familiar with what they are and where they come from, but a little history lesson, firefighting foams, anything that repels oil and water, your Teflon pans. So we all love our nonstick pans, but they were coated with PFAS prior to, I think it was 2015. And subsequently, they got in our groundwater supply. Next slide, April. So where we are now, the California Division of Drinking Water has set notification levels and response levels. And the slide after this kind of shows the timeline, but I'll just talk about where we are now. So a notification level is a regulatory requirement where if you exceed it, you have to notify your governing bodies. So our agency needs to notify you all, the board of directors, as well as the city and the county. And so if you exceed these in the current notification levels for PFOA and PFOS, the two that DDW, Division of Drinking Water, is currently focused on are 5.1 parts per trillion and 6.5 parts per trillion respectively. They also went through and adjusted the response level. And the current response level for PFOA is 10 parts per trillion and PFOS 40 parts per trillion. So the response level is just a recommendation from Division of Drinking Water that you take the source out of service. We are doing that. You're not required to, but you have to do additional notification if you don't. So if a water agency chooses to use a source of supply that exceeds a response level, there's additional notification to your customers beyond just notifying your governing bodies. Okay, I guess that's it. Next one, please, April. So here's sort of the timeline. We were first introduced to it in 2012, 2016 with the UCMR 4, I think it was. And what the UCMR is unregulated contaminant monitoring rule. So back when the 1996 Safe Drinking Water Act amendments, second round of amendments came out, they developed these things called UCMR, where the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, has to look at emerging contaminants and then create a priority list, and every 5 years issue orders for water utilities to sample those. And so that was our first exposure to them, because there were a few of them on that list. And then we took samples in 2014 for the UCMR 4, and we had 6 wells that had positive detections. But we weren't alarmed by this, because you have detections on a lot of unregulated contaminants that you sample for throughout the years. And then it goes through a regulatory process of prevalence and the health aspects of it as well. So in 2016, EPA did take action, and they created something called a lifetime health advisory level. And it was a combined level of both PFOA and PFOS, and that's of 70 parts per trillion. So they developed that and put that out in 2016. In 2018, the Division of Drinking Water issued orders to water utilities in the state to sample for these constituents, and they developed notification levels of 13 for PFOS and 14 for PFOA, and they adopted the 70 lifetime health advisory level of 70, the combined. And that was when they set up the phased approach. So I guess I spoke incorrectly there. In 2019, in March, is when we received our first orders to start sampling. And so we sampled 15 wells, and how they decided on those first 15 wells was based on our initial 6 detections, so that we had to sample the 6 wells that had positive detections, and then any well within a mile radius. So they selected 15 wells initially for us. So on the first round, we sampled those 15 wells, and we had detections, and we had one well that exceeded the 70. It was Valley Center well, and we immediately shut it off. Again, there wasn't a requirement at that time. It's just a recommended level for the response level, but we decided to do that. And then what we also did was we brought this to the board to start talking about it. I think it was in May of 2019. And then the agency made the decision to sample all of our wells. So we went beyond the 15 required wells initially when we started sampling. And then in 2020, DDW lowered the response level of PFOA to 10 parts per trillion and PFOS to 40 parts per trillion. And as a result of that, this is on a running annual average. So the response level is on a running annual average now. So technically you can have a well that exceeds it for 3 consecutive quarters, these response levels. But on the 4th one, if your running annual average exceeds it, then they recommend that you shut it off. Again, we decided to proactively shut off these wells. And currently we have 17 wells that are off as a result of an exceedance of PFOA's 10 parts per trillion. We don't have any exceedance of the PFOS 40 parts per trillion. April, next slide. So in terms of reliability, you know, our agency has about 70,000 service connections, which serves approximately 240,000 residents in the Santa Clarita Valley. Local groundwater supply is about half of our supply, and then the imported water from the State Water Project makes up the other half, and then a small portion currently is provided by recycled water. The 17 wells that are off make up a little bit over 40% of our available groundwater supply. And then the image is just showing our overall service area boundary. And we're still showing the separate divisional service areas, because under Division of Drinking Water, we have separate operating permits at this time, even though we're all operating as one agency. Next slide, please, April. Oh, I forgot there was a little animation. What this does, go to the next one. I think it zooms in. There you go. So this shows all of our wells, and the blue ones are the ones that are currently impacted by PFAS. And then we call them the non-impacted ones, or those green dots. So primarily on the main stem of the Santa Clara River. And I think there's 17 blue dots currently. And let's go to the next slide, April. So what else we did in addition to bringing it to the board's attention in May of 2019 and sampling all of our wells, we formed an internal PFAS strike team. And we meet every other Friday to discuss updates and our approach and how we're going to handle things. We do have some consultants that come in to talk about various projects they're working on for us to install treatment. We hired WQTS, Water Quality Treatment Solutions, to do some bench scale testing to compare carbon, granular activated carbon or resin for the removal. And they actually took water from our wells to do this. They didn't just use some base point PFAS values. They looked at our current levels. We developed a short-term or a short list of priority in system interconnections. So I wish Director Astafi was still here. He would appreciate it. One of the goals of the agency is to operate as one solid distribution system, because technically we're all connected through the import line through all of our turnout connections, but we have individual operating permits. But we did identify two key interconnections, one between the Tesoro system, which is just the north portion of Valencia, and Valencia's distribution system zone 3A, and then another one between Santa Clarita's Bouquet zone and Valencia's 2A north. And we've constructed those ourselves internally, designed and constructed. And then we got permits from Division of Drinking Water to operate these. And what this enables us to do is our the zone that was hit the hardest with PFAS well shutdowns was Valencia's 2A north. And so this allowed us to move water a little more efficiently, and it provides some operational flexibility for us. We also decided to pre-order vessels. We had the foresight to think of the fact that these vessels have a long lead time because they're not sitting on some shelf. They have to be manufactured. And so we pre-ordered vessels, and which was quite unique. You know, working with our engineering folks who did an amazing job outside of their comfort zone, right? So typically engineers like to plan, then they like to design, then they like to construct. Well, working with a bunch of operations guys, we just said, let's do it all at the same time. And so we were able to get the NWELLS project from start to completion in about 1 year, and that includes permitting through Division of Drinking Water. And we are, this agency is the first PFAS treatment utilizing resin ion exchange, which I think is pretty amazing feat that we did. We also hired, and our water resources group have been leading the effort with Kennedy Jenks to help implement sort of a plan of where we go from here. So we knew that the biggest bang for our buck would be the NWELLS, because there are three wells. We had the property. They produce about 6,200 gallons a minute, and it was in the zone 2A north, and so we felt it would be the best spot to start. And then Kennedy Jenks created this plan to help us go forward from here. Next slide, please. And I think that's it for me. And I'll wait unless anybody wants to ask questions now, but it's probably easier since we're online to do it at the end. So Steve, it's all yours.
Great. Thanks, Mike. I think that was, you know, a great presentation of kind of the why. We'll talk a little bit more about the how, and then we'll ultimately get to the what it, you know, it's going to take overall. So one thing I wanted to talk about that we sometimes take for granted now is outreach. Kathy Martin and her group
did an amazing job of outreach on this topic, you know, not only as it evolved from what Mike had discussed as kind of the notification process, but went into to project management and just overall education of our customer base about the challenge we're facing and how we're trying to deal with it. As you can see here, I mean, it just was a full gamut approach, and it was very well received. I, you know, so much so that Kathy and her team received a couple of awards through this process. So I just wanted to take a couple minutes to thank Kathy and her group for their efforts. Just wanted to kind of walk through this for the board from a kind of proof of concept, as Mike talked about it with the NOLs. And we're going to talk about kind of the near term or what's next for us and our steps, and then more of the long term. And then ultimately, the work that Kennedy Jenks had done in trying to put a all-in cost estimate together so that the board understands the level you know, of effort, not only from a manpower standpoint, but from just an overall agency financial aspect of dealing with this issue. As Mike said, the NOLs treatment was a hugely successful project. It is online. It has restored a huge amount of the lost capacity. You know, as Mike said, that we put that strike team together and to be able to move in a matter of just, you know, a little bit over a year to getting from kind of concept to project delivery was amazing. And it took everybody. That strike team's got our whole organization teams involved, and as well as the board. The board recognizing that they wanted to move forward with tackling this issue head on and dealing with it. And being able to have that support has really made this project a success. And so what we're doing is we're building on that. Obviously, there's more treatment to go. And so we're starting to do that. Here's April, if you can go to the next slide. And I probably should have asked you before. So there's a picture of the in-well treatment. Next slide after that is kind of an aerial picture of the treatment at in-well. So right over by Hart Baseball Field. You can see the size and scale of the facility there. Next slide, April. So shifting to more now from the kind of proof of concept project, to actually prioritizing the near-term goals for what's next. And so, as I mentioned, Kennedy Jenks Consultant was brought on board to help us evaluate schedule and cost and viability of treatment at these other locations. So these are kind of our near-term projects. We've prioritized them. And you can see the list there. It's long. And we've got a lot of work yet to go. You can see the estimated restoration date. I would say those are pretty aggressive, but we wanted to be aggressive to make sure that we're moving forward as quickly as possible on restoring the lost capacity. Next slide, April. Here's the remaining list of what wells are impacted. And I should say that both these lists were built with a target of 80% of the RL. So we tried to build in a little bit of conservatism as the regulatory standard is still evolving. There will be a maximum contaminant level set, but it's probably a couple years out as that process moves forward. So we're trying to be not overly conservative, but still take an approach that is going to be protective of the agency over the long run. So this is basically the list of the other wells that fall in that criteria. You can see some of these
When you get out to the east end, like the last one there, for example, priority-wise, that's an area of the groundwater basin that during droughts experiences challenges with pumping on that end, and therefore it hasn't been highly prioritized as those wells are sometimes out of operation anyway in current operational standards. Next slide, April. So here we want to start talking about the financial implications of the treatment plan that we're putting together. These are a lot more developed and have a lot more technical basis for how we've put this together. So you can see if we were to treat, you know, everything all the way through the pine tree wells, we're estimating that total capital cost investment of a little bit over $105 million at this point. So as we start talking about our rate study coming up, I think you're going to see, you know, that PFAS is the driver of those costs in that rate study. And this is one reflection of that. We'll talk a little bit at the end about policy options for how to handle the financial element of capital costs for this challenge. Next slide, April. That may have just put a red ring on, so it's the annual O&M slide that we need to be on now. So obviously, capital costs is just, you know, that's the equipment, getting the pipes and the pumps and the vessels and all that stuff built and installed to treat. But there's also an annual O&M cost component to treatment, and that's what this slide reflects. And so you can see an estimate of those O&M costs per year. Again, if we decided to move through all wells, that treatment could rise to right about $12.5 million. One thing I will say, these numbers will get even further trued up because we do have a proof of concept, and it's running. So that first one there, the in wells on the spreadsheet, we will have, you know, after a year, actual run costs, and we'll be able to readjust these spreadsheets to reflect that. We also have the capital component at that site too that we'll be able to adjust once all those numbers are in and booked. Next slide, April. That one probably put just a red circle also. Next slide. So, you know, estimated for O&M costs, I just wanted to point out, you know, as Mike said earlier, we spent some time at the front end picking treatment methodology. And in our area, in an inland area, it becomes really difficult for PFAS technology, meaning that there's only a few viable technologies that are out there right now. Mike mentioned two of those. Granular activated carbon, and then resin. We had experience with resin to remove perchlorate treatment, but the bench testing also showed that resin was most likely the best way to go when you took into consideration some of the other challenges of the other treatment methodologies. For example, with GAC, you actually have to do some backwashing, and you know, then you start looking at, well, where does the backwash water go? And you end up in the same, you know, circular logic loop on that. It goes to the, either to the river or it goes to the sanitation plant. And that backwash water is going to have PFAS in it. So that was pretty much taken out at the front end. It also took about twice as much footprint to do GAC versus resin treatment. And so that's why a little bit more background on why we went with resin. But you can see the resin's the driver in the O&M cost. It's, you know, over 70% of the cost for the O&M. Next slide, April. So want to talk some about, obviously, the financial considerations. The KJET study wanted to look at kind of both the prioritization, the viability of getting the treatment installed, and then also the how much it's going to cost. So the what's it going to take to deal with this issue. As we talked about earlier, operations and maintenance, about $12.7 million per year at the end of the game. The current rate case has built in a $22 million over the next five-year period. So it's basically starts at a $2.5 million O&M rate and builds up to $8.5 million in the final year of that. That rate study. So, and that total equals $22 million. So that we're trying to build in, obviously the O&M costs, those are best to be covered through rates. The capital component is probably a different discussion that we're going to be having. And you'll see this coming to the board soon as a policy level discussion about how we want to fund the capital costs for PFAS treatment for the Valley. So far, we've done a couple things. One, we are paying for mainly the NWELs, and they have a little bit left over to do some other the planning on the other wells, but about $11 million was included in the recent bond financing for that activity. We also have, as Brent mentioned in his presentation, as part of the Lark Ranch State Water Resources Control Board grant, it looks like we're eligible for a $10 million grant in addition to the Lark project. So that's on the table. We'll know more in the next few months about the viability of that proposal, whether it's a zero interest or just very low interest loan or grant for the project. We are also, staff is researching state revolving fund low interest loans. So that's another tool in the toolkit that we can, as a water agency, participate in. So we're going to map out the viability of that. Obviously, there's always, you know, the kind of the other traditional approach of additional bond financing. We are going to be pursuing state and federal grant opportunities in addition to these funding strategies. And then there's PAYGO. You know, PAYGO, we have some reserve PAYGO, if the board remembers that, that we can leverage. And then, you know, ultimately PAYGO is something that may put some additional pressure on rates as well. Next slide, April. So just summarizing, you know, basically 28 wells. That was the numbers that we're looking at for PFAS compliance. Again, that was that 80% of the RL cutoff point. You can see the 17 wells that are actually offline and are prioritized for restoration in the near term. And that makes up about $64.5 million in capital investment. Again, we chose IX ion exchange as the treatment choice. We've prioritized the wells based upon where they're needed most. And then the total estimated cost for PFAS compliance, again, is right around a capital number of $106 million and an annual O&M stream of about $2.7 million at full treatment. So with that, I will stop. And I believe Mike and I are available for questions.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate the presentation. I will start with Director Planback. Do you have any questions for Mike or Steve, or Mike and Steve?
Yes, the e-wells, that were four of them that were affected by PFAS, are under the influence of the effluent from the sanitation district. So the sanitation district is adding to the PFAS in those wells. Is there any chance that they will make some contribution to helping to clean them up?
Steve, you want to take that or you want me to?
Yeah, no, I can take it. So it truly is a chicken and egg question. I think, you know, when the SAM district folks look at it, they say your wells have PFAS in them, and they pump and they get used, and then that goes into the sewage treatment plant. So so far, Director Plenbeck, our focus has been on cost recovery through the manufacturers themselves. We were looking for, and still have not foreclosed on the opportunity to look for, you know, principal responsible parties, kind of like what we did with perchlorate. But what we're finding is that if you look in the watershed, you know, we're finding PFAS above the treatment plant also. And so the most viable approach that we thought from a cost recovery standpoint was to go over and pursue the actual manufacturers of the chemicals themselves. We will be having a closed session tonight to talk about that approach specifically in a little bit more detail.
And then Director Plante,
I don't think with the number of the amount of litigation, I don't think we're going to get a whole bunch of money out of that. And technically, whether it comes from our water or not, I think once it comes out of their spout, they have some responsibility as well. I mean, they could put in some kind of reverse osmosis, which maybe the chloride reverse osmosis would be helping with this. But I think they can't get off the hook by blaming us when they have the effluent pollution coming out of their spout too. So it would be me, I guess, but maybe sharing the cost would be helpful for everybody.
And Director Plenbeck, I just wanted to add for clarification, the e-wells currently don't exceed any of the NLs, any of the notification levels. They're within the 80% range that Steve mentioned as a conservative approach. So I just wanted to make that clarification.
Yeah, I'll just add, I think it is a good point that with chloride removal, there may be some ancillary benefit there. And we certainly are, you know, aware of that. And I think the sanitation district isn't trying to lay off blame. They're we're just trying to explain the water cycle and the difficulty of isolating fault. But mm-hmm. I don't think it precludes discussions on where the best mitigation funds could be expended. Obviously, it's something we want to get out of the water cycle ultimately. But I think rather than suing ourselves over it, we would probably want to try to approach it constructively first and see where that got.
Well, yeah, I was thinking is if they were able to take some responsibility for it, since it does come out of their pipe also, that maybe enhancing the chloride treatment facilities would be cheaper than adding wellhead treatment on the wells. I mean, if you're not, you have them down as doing that eventually. So even though they're below the notification level, I guess you're going to still try to put a wellhead treatment on them. So it might just be a cheaper way to do it. I'm just throwing that out there, just an idea.
It's certainly the kind of question that we could ask, I think, collaboratively. I do think the effluent tends to be probably a little more likely to consume the available space in the media with other constituents that are there at small levels. It's worth a discussion. I don't think that would preclude us from going forward with some targeted treatment on our wells to make sure that they can be in service. But this is going to be a long-term problem, and that may ultimately be a way to taper off the need to operate these plants, you know, in the later years, if we can get it out of the water cycle. Mm-hmm. I'll note that the O&M costs are, you know, fairly significant for these. So capital is certainly a big investment. But when you amortize that, if we were to finance it in some way, the O&M costs are really the driver on this from a cost recovery standpoint.
Okay, thank you. That was the only question and suggestion I had.
Thank you, Director Planback. Director Ozahosky, do you have any questions for the presenters?
I do. So Mr. Alvord and Mr. Call, thank you for a comprehensive summary. It's always good to hear that operations and engineering will work very well together. It's been my experience that those two departments don't really get along. So it's, kudos to the engineering team and operations for working together and getting this done. Regarding the NWELs, during our last meeting, was presented that the chemical feed pumps were could not handle the flow rate, so larger ones were going to be ordered and installed.